You're listening to New Hampshire Now with Chris Ryan, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also this fall by Carter Hill Orchard.
This is New Hampshire Now, 1914-50 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Chris, joining us for the program this hour of New Hampshire Now is presented by ARP New Hampshire, as well as the Concord Food Co-op. And this segment of the show brought to you by Rath Young and Pignatelli, a national impact that's uniquely New Hampshire. For more information, check out rathlaw.com. We are inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street Studio. I'm going to be joined by Congressman Tim Ryan from Ohio as we kick off once again our series with ARP New Hampshire, focusing on middle-class issues. We come to you today, though, after the Democratic debate last night. 10 candidates were on the stage, 9 were not. And before we get into the debate itself, I mean, what was it like for you watching a debate, knowing that you probably should have been a part of the debate, that you're a serious candidate for president? I mean, it's got to be like a guy who is injured on a basketball team watching his team play in the playoffs, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit of that. You're on the sidelines and you want into the game. But it is what it is. And the reality of it is, you know, we've seen Kamala have a moment. She went up, back down. Cory Booker, a couple of debates ago, everyone thought he had a moment, didn't move in the polls. So I think, you know, what I would definitely want to be on the stage. I'd be lying if I said I didn't. I don't think it's necessarily, you know, because I would have been one of the people more on the end. And so while all the stuff was going down, again, it reminded me a lot. I was like, when I was watching, I was like, that's exactly what happened when I was on. It was the first 35 or 40 minutes are all, you know, the top three people.
Biden, Bernie, as well as Elizabeth Warren. And then they started to bring in other individuals into the healthcare conversation. So you mentioned that there is not a tremendous amount of benefit for you or, you know, Senator Bennett or others being on the stage as compared to Julian Castro and perhaps others who are on the fringe aspect of the conversation. So how does this race change, though, for an individual that is either outside the debate or inside of the debate? Because you're, you know, unlikely to be able to make the next round, and then the threshold is going to increase once again after that.
I think you got to move the poll numbers in a couple of the early states or in a early state. And that's been our goal. You know, I kind of was a little bit mad at myself for playing the game of the low dollar donations.
Right.
Because that was just insane. And, you know, obviously you live and you learn. But to me, now having people spend $50-$60 to get a $1 contribution in order to meet this artificial threshold doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so we decided, you know, 6-8 weeks ago, like, we're going to start focusing on early states. We're going to go on the grassroots. This is how I got elected to the state Senate. This is how I got elected to Congress. I like doing it. You know, last night we were in the bars in Concord getting volunteers. You know, we actually ended up crashing a Beto party.
Nice. I like your style.
We heard they were there, and so we thought we'd pay a visit. You know,
just I like it. I also was, you know, curious from from your perspective, if you think you have to focus on one state in particular, because that's something I've been saying for the candidates outside of the top tier, outside of perhaps Buttigieg and Harris, who have the resources to play in multiple states. I feel like whether it's you or Klobuchar, Booker, that you need to focus on one specific state and have that, you know, McCain, Kasich type of all-in strategy. Do you feel you need to do that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're playing in Iowa because we think there's a natural Midwest thing there, but I've got a base here in New Hampshire through going to law school at Franklin Pierce. Dan O'Neill, Bill Berry, Tim Baines have endorsed my campaign, some significant players down in Manchester. We've got another endorsement or two we're going to roll out here in the next 24 hours probably in Manchester. So we've got a natural foothold, I think, here. And we've been doing really well in South Carolina. I mean, we've pulled about 11 endorsements, a lot of them from Joe Biden, most of them from the African-American community, which makes up about 60% of the vote in South Carolina. So Vice President Biden's former co-chair in 08 is with us. His former political director in 08 is with us. One of his top faith-based people are with us from 08. So we've got a nice foothold down there, too. And so we're just going to keep plugging away. And that's going to be the key. If we stop getting momentum, that's one thing. But we're getting momentum. We're getting endorsements. And I think that's how you end up moving the needle here.
Todd?
So welcome back, Congressman.
Thank
it's good
you.
To see you.
Thanks.
So a little bit about AARP New Hampshire. We have about 227,000 members in New Hampshire. It's a few.
Pretty
big number. And another great factoid is about 382,606 people over 50 voted in the 2016 presidential primary.
I'm going to write that down here.
Yeah, so, yeah, I don't have too many more. Yeah, I got some other data, but those ones are committed to memory. So, you know, obviously the issues of importance to them because they vote are things like Social Security and Medicare and prescription drugs. But I'll start with prescription drugs. You know, we have some good data, and I'm happy to share it with you and your campaign. But in 2016, 26% of New Hampshire residents stopped taking meds as prescribed due to costs. And I think you've spoken about this before, but as you know, for the past decade, you know, brand name drug prices have gone up significantly faster than the rate of inflation. So while inflation, as you know, has been relatively flat since 08, I mean, you still see these great spikes. Mm-hmm. So if you're elected president, what's the first thing that you'll do to lower prescription drug prices?
Try to get the Medicare program to be able to negotiate down these prices. You know, just to let people know how personal this is, when I was at my mom's house on Mother's Day, she's a 74-year-old Italian woman, and she, you know, she had her finger in my face. She said, when you get in, you better take care of these prescription drugs. You know, she fell into the donut hole. She worked for the local county clerk of court's office, so she was supposed to have good public worker benefits, and she fell into the donut hole. She's paying $1,000 a month. So in my family, we know the challenges that seniors are facing. I'm deeply committed to doing this, not just for my mom, but for everyone else who's worked really hard their entire lives and tried to get it. And I think the Medicare program negotiating down these drug prices will then set the price for the market. We have all these consumers. Why wouldn't we use their buying power to negotiate down the prices?
Great. Thank you. So, you know, another question I have along the same lines is, how would you specifically hold the drug companies accountable for the high prescription drug prices? And, you know, another interesting stat we have on this is that by our numbers, Big Pharma spent nearly $169 million for lobbying and more than $6 billion for advertising in 2018. And nearly 80% of every Big Pharma dollar goes to something other than R&D.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you hold them accountable in a very real way in the office of the presidency, by executive order or otherwise?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of it should be making sure that there's not an increased market for them or market share for them, making sure that there's no monopolies developing within the industries. I think we should ban the advertising. I really don't think a drug company should be advertising their drugs. If you get sick and you need a drug, that's one thing, but to have people advertising what you should start thinking you have, you know, or blowing, like you said, blowing all that money. And I actually think, and this is something that we need to look into deeper, but a lot of the R&D that is done, the basic research that is done by the taxpayer. So this is the ultimate scam. Like, the taxpayer funds National Institutes of Health. Taxpayers fund this basic research. The companies come in and they pluck out a patent, and they take that drug and they manipulate it in a couple of different ways, and then they make a lot of money off it. And then they screw the taxpayer with the price. So I think there's got to be something within the context of them accessing our basic research. I also think we need to clamp down on the way they can just manipulate a pill once it gets past its 7-year patent, and they just change the shape or change the color, and all of a sudden it's a new pill, and you get through that loophole. So closing down those loopholes is going to be really important for us.
You mean the loopholes to prevent generics from coming to market?
Well, not generics coming to market, but them being able to manipulate what would be a generic.
But for the patent extension.
Well, but yeah, they change the color of the pill, or they cut the pill in an octagon instead of a square, and all of a sudden they try to claim it's some new pill, so therefore it's not a generic. It priced at a generic level. It's priced at a premium level.
Right.
And it's those kind of manipulations that we need to address.
What should the drug company's responsibility be in regards to the opioid epidemic? We're seeing states, individuals sue drug companies for responsibility in regards to that. John Delaney was here and said he feels that they're going to be drug companies that are going to go bankrupt as a result of civil action and state action. What is your feeling in regards to that, and what would you direct the Attorney General's office to do in regards to investigating the role that drug companies have played in the opioid epidemic?
Well, coming from Ohio, where I went to a school a year and a half ago, and six or seven parents died in that school due to overdose.
A lot of the middle class wealthy.
Totally.
All across the board.
It's across the board. Yeah. I mean, this is a working class community, yep. White, black, brown people. And so it's touching everybody. I think this lawsuit should go down as it is going down. It should have the support of the federal government behind it. We should have better monitoring of what, especially when there's a epidemic happening in the country, that these drug companies, again, are making tons of money, and the VP of marketing is making tens of millions of dollars a year. The human resource person is making tens of millions of dollars a year. They're clearly benefiting from it. And there's a town in West Virginia where everybody in the town has 300 opiate pills. Mm-hmm. I mean, by the numbers. And to me, it's an example of how unbalanced that there's this protected class of people in the country that are making lots of money at the expense of everybody else. And that, to me, is, I think, as Democrats, is something that we should really not be okay with. So using every ounce of power, investigatory power within the Department of Justice, having an active Department of Justice, trying to level the playing field, because at the end of the day, it's my mom, it's your members at AARP that are ultimately suffering, or the people who are overdosing, or the kids who lose their parents, or I mean, and.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what I think, this is the inflection point we're at in the country. What is the role of the federal government?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean for us as Democrats? What does it mean to be a Democrat? Mm-hmm. And it means, in my estimation, using the power of the federal government to help people who are getting screwed somehow in this process, whether it's drug pricing or overdosing or school funding or whatever else it is. To me, that's the big question we need to answer.
One of the major challenges for middle-class families and individuals is cost. Individuals may make a significant amount of money and still find themselves struggling to get by and living paycheck to paycheck based upon loans, mortgages, cars, and things that are necessities. Now, there's also the aspect of cost that we can control. We don't necessarily need our cell phone or our cable bill.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to watch the Red Sox. Maybe not this season. but in regards to that, I mean, how much of a focus should there be, in your view, and prescription drugs obviously fall into this, in trying to do what you can, from what you're describing before, from the federal government's role, in controlling the costs and controlling costs, whether it's taxation, credit cards, student loans? How do you go about trying to create an environment where the middle class is not always behind and has more discretionary spending?
Well, you get back to where, you have to regulate markets. I mean, mm-hmm. even the old school Republicans, I mean, not now, but like back in the day, it was like everybody agreed on markets need to be well regulated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you function within the context of the system. And when you had well regulated markets, when you had a fair tax system, you had CEOs, they made more than the person on the factory floor. In the late 70s, it was about 30 times more than the person on the factory floor the worker was making. Now it's 330 times. And so taxation and reinvestment back into the community, strong unions so that unions are negotiating prices, they're negotiating contracts, they're negotiating benefits. They can then make deals because they're a union. They can then make deals maybe with other unions to try to control costs. Mm-hmm. And make investments. So doing everything you can to build up the middle class. But again, it's about, and I talk a lot about an industrial policy in the United States so that we're actually making investments into the growing sectors of the economy that are growing 30-40%. How do we start making things again in the United States? How do we build electric vehicles, solar, wind, unionize those jobs so we have a strong middle class? So it has to be done at every single level.
Yes, Congressman, I've heard you speak a couple times, obviously, about about unions and industrial concerns, and those are good jobs when we're making things, and not to denigrate at all the service industry, but in many cases the manufacturing sector will generate higher wages, and you know that's obviously good for many. But again, going back to a couple staples for us, Social Security, Medicare, mm-hmm. and I just want to frame it in terms of a micro approach and a macro approach. So mm-hmm. the micro approach on Social Security is we have a lot of people over 50 in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. Obviously they're not claiming Social Security at 50, but nonetheless they can see it coming. Mm-hmm. It's about $1,300 a month is the average Social Security benefit in New Hampshire, maybe mm-hmm. $1,400 for men, $1,100 for women, and they really rely upon that. And then Medicare, another interesting thing in New Hampshire, some of our bigger communities, maybe most of them, are anchored by healthcare institutions now. If you've been around the state, you mm-hmm. know that, right? Mm-hmm. So Concord Hospital in Concord, CMC in Elliott, and Manchester, name a few, Upper Valley of Dartmouth. So Medicare obviously provides a needed guaranteed benefit of healthcare to people over 65, but also it's got a massive macro approach in New Hampshire given the numbers of people using that program. So with that said, macro and micro perspectives on Social Security and Medicare, how would you update and strengthen Social Security and Medicare to keep them strong for current generations and future generations? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts on it. First on Social Security, I'm a original co-sponsor of Social Security 2100 Act, Congressman John Larson's legislation from Connecticut. And basically what that does is there's a cap at $125,000, $130,000 of everybody pays Social Security tax up till that amount. And then it goes away. So Warren Buffett doesn't pay it and everything over $125,000 to $130,000. So under my plan, we would reestablish that tax at $400,000 a year and up. And that basically extends the life of the Social Security program to 2100. So we're giving young people some certainty that it's going to be there for them. We've got people who are accessing the program right now or just getting into the program, some certainty that they're going to get it. In a few years, we have to charge everybody across the board, I think it's the price of not even a cup of coffee, a week in order to keep the program solvent. We actually have a 12 to 13 million people actually see an increase, so the poorest 12 or 13 million people in the Social Security program will actually see an increase in pay, and we also have a tax cut in there where we lift the cap on how much you can make before things are taxable. Mm-hmm. We double that so people can make a little bit more money. And so that, to me, is a very practical way to extend the life of the program. When it comes to the Medicare program, I think we've got to do a couple of different things, like I think generally in the healthcare system. And you can't see just the Medicare program as it sits by itself, because what we have now, and I see this a lot in Ohio, people don't have healthcare at 60 or 61 or 62 or 63. And if they need a hip replacement, they need a knee replacement, they need a surgery, they wait. They wait until they get into the Medicare program. And so that has a significant impact on the Medicare program, because not only are they waiting to get it done, they're probably worse off
when they get there.
Yeah, than they would have been if they would have had access to healthcare. So I think my plan brings the Medicare program down to 50. And so between 50 and 64, you can buy into the program. And so it's revenue neutral. And we're going to have a healthier cohort going into the original Medicare program, which is going to mean everybody's healthier. But we've also got to address this broader issue. Same talked about prescription drugs, which can be a significant savings that'll extend the life of the program. We do have to cut down on waste, fraud, and abuse. That's about $1 billion a week in the program, where doctors or whomever are scamming the system. That's $50 billion a year.
Right.
Now, we're going to get those savings. We're not going to give it to Warren Buffett in a tax cut. We're going to reinvest it back into the Medicare program. And then lastly, I would just say, across the board in society, about two-thirds of our healthcare costs, three-quarters of our healthcare costs, are chronic diseases that are preventable. So I know you're facing this in the Medicare program with type 2 diabetes.
Right.
These are reversible diseases, and I think a lot of people are surprised by that. But we are literally reversing type 2 diabetes with approaches like food as medicine, with other interventions for $5,000 or $10,000. You can actually reverse type 2 diabetes, which we're spending $14,000 a year on. So to actually reverse it, those are the kind of strategies we need to implement, not just in the Medicare program, but how do we figure out to have a healthier people going into the Medicare program?
So you're taking a more holistic approach. So, yeah, I appreciate that.
Well, we have to. I mean, there's no other way to do it. And those costs, those chronic diseases that are largely preventable, are $3.5 trillion a year to healthcare, the healthcare system. And so if we're going to deal with the $1 trillion a year annual deficit that we now have, we've got to figure out how to get some savings, and most of it's going to come from us getting healthy.
Do you have, and I think you do, I can't recall it specifically, but you have a vision for helping Americans to live independently in their communities as they age, because most people want to stay in their homes and communities as they age. It's a convenient place to have them stay. It's what they prefer. Mm-hmm. And it's probably most cost effective. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, I'm speaking of people who don't need to have institutional round-the-clock care. That's a different demographic. But what's your vision for that?
Well, a lot of it's affordability. And we see this happen a lot, where you live in a home that you've lived in your whole life, and all of a sudden investments come in, property values go up, your taxes go up, and to the point where you can no longer afford your taxes. You may not even have a house payment anymore, but you can't afford your taxes. And we see this a lot in South Carolina. And so we need to address that issue. And I don't know if it's through tax credits or write-offs, if people are in that situation, that they get some kind of tax break. The increase in the Social Security thing I talked about can be helpful. But we've got to focus on affordable housing, low-income housing. And that means we've got to like triple or quadruple the low-income tax credit, because you need to make sure that investors have the profit motive to be able to build these homes. And it's pretty straightforward. Most of the stuff is local other than that. But I think if we triple or quadruple the low-income tax credit for builders, we could continue to have homes that are affordable. But there's got to be protections for that person who does not want to move out of their house. And then expanding access to home health care.
Got it.
And that's going to be the way to do it.
My final question, then I'll stop, Chris. In a Ryan presidency, does any one of those topics?
I thought you were talking about me there for a second. I got excited.
Hey, man.
I was just talking about
Ryan and Ryan 2020. Let's do this thing. We'll get every Irish vote in America.
<True. laughs> And that's all we'll need.
That's all we'll need.
Okay, well, you know, you get me going with a name like Fahey, too. So.
Oh, there you go. Secretary of something.
Are you do any of these things make your first 100 days in a Ryan presidency?
I think the negotiation with the drug prices has got to be very early on. I mean, I think that's the most straightforward way to do it. I think it's the most politically compelling thing to do. And it will expose those people who take all those lobbyist dollars from the pharmaceutical companies. It will expose which side they're on.
Thank you.
That is Tim Ryan joining us here on Hampshire Now, 159-1450 and nhtalkradio.com. This hour of the program is presented by ARP New Hampshire, as well as the Concord Food Co-op, and this segment of the program presented by Rathjung and Pignatelli. In conclusion, there's an article in Bloomberg last week in which you were highly critical of Joe Biden, and saying that you do not think he has the energy to defeat President Trump, that he is declining. Your quote was, "I think Biden is declining. I don't think he has the energy. You see it almost daily, and I love that guy." Do you regret saying that? And what was the context of that? Because there's some question as to whether you knew it was reported.
Yeah, no,
or
it
not,
was
or?
It was a private conversation, and you know that reporter has zero ethics, is my
okay.
opinion, and zero integrity, and I let him know that. So I really don't want to get into it. You know, I love Joe Biden. I'm going to try to express my vision and my energy and, you know, my view of the world and where we need to go. And I'm just going to kind of leave it at that.
Given that you made, you know, those comments on background and they obviously were brought to the forefront, I'm curious as to what you thought when you saw Julian Castro go after the vice president the way he did during the course of the debate.
I actually didn't see it.
Okay.
I was here in Concord. I was literally going around in restaurants and bars and shaking hands and
So if there are questions, basically for those who did not see it either, Secretary Castro numerous times said that the vice president could not remember what he just said in regards to a debate about how Biden's health care plan would affect low-income individuals. When in fact, Biden did remember what he just said, and it was Julian Castro who was miscategorizing the vice president's remarks. And it plays to, in your comments off the record, and has played this larger narrative, though, that there is concern about the vitality of Joe Biden. And do you feel that that is an appropriate conversation that should take place, or should voters make, you know, their own determinations in regards to whether he still, quote unquote, has it?
Well, I don't think, you know, you always need to point out the flaws. I think we should keep it off of the personal, and people will see the candidates. I think we should keep it focused on the issues to the extent we can, and do what you have to do. But I didn't hear what Biden said. I saw a clip of what Castro said, and so I couldn't put it into context as to, you know, what the vice president said. I just think we have got to put up the strongest possible person to beat Donald Trump. And I'm in this race because I think it's me. I think, you know, a blue-collar guy from Youngstown, Ohio, that can win Michigan and Wisconsin, and I have a big vision for the country and a lot of other things. That's the recipe to beat this guy. And I think a generational change is what we need. I think the country's looking for a generational change, especially in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm just going to try to get out there. But, you know, I hope we can keep it all above board.
And that lane, in my view, is the most populated lane, the new leadership lane. Mm-hmm. But there you have these three individuals that are firmly cemented, I would say, in the top three based upon their name ID and you know, their positioning in regards to finances and everything. Mm-hmm. So what are the challenges of trying to break through in that particular lane? Kind of bringing it back to what we were talking about before, where there is a thirst for that. The numbers indicate that that's what most Democratic primary voters want, mm-hmm. but you have that lane populated, it would seem, by 15 individuals.
That's why I think it's going to come down to who's walking around the bars in Concord in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and shaking hands and looking people in the eye, and they like you and they are going to vote for you and they're going to come volunteer for you. Like, who can do that over the course of September, October, November, December?
I agree. I think, you know, good ground game and focusing on a specific state will allow for individuals. It's not going to happen in the debates. You're going to go up, you're going to go down. There's not going to be a lot of fluctuation there. We've seen that.
Yeah.
But I think that the shoe leather aspect of things, running a Kasich, McCain type of campaign with this focused on Iowa or New Hampshire, could pay off for any of the, you know, 15 individuals.
Yeah. And you got to, I mean, it's not just that. You've also got to have the vision.
Yes.
And really, you know, I think, you know, that's what Kasich was talking about in New Hampshire.
Bring people together.
Correct. And, you know, I've obviously got issues with John Kasich, but that was, I thought he did a great job of articulating that. Obviously,
I like John Kasich a lot, and I have issues with John Kasich. Everybody has issues.
John Kasich has issues with John Kasich. and, you know, McCain wove that beautiful articulation of America.
Right, exactly.
Of what his vision was for America, and that's why he went from number 7 to, you know, number 1, and that's doable here, and I think that's the magic of the system. That's why everyone's saying, "Oh my God, you need to get out. You didn't make the debate." It was just funny. We walked into these pubs around here and nobody was watching the debate.
Right.
Like, everyone was watching football or, you know, BSing with whoever they were there with, and it was like, vast majority of Americans aren't paying a lick of attention.
Yep.
Get in here, meet them, shake their hands. They'll remember you if you see them at a football game or a bowling alley. And that's how you win elections, and that's what we're going
to
focus on.
Congressman, great to see you as always. Look forward to talking again soon.
Yep. TimRyanForAmerica.com if anybody wants to check out the campaign or volunteer.
Tim Ryan here on New Hampshire Now. 159-1450 and NHTalkRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan along with Todd Fahey. This hour of the show presented by ARP New Hampshire as well as the Concord Food Co-op. And that segment of the program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now with Chris Ryan, presented by the New Hampshire College and University Council, and also this fall by Carter Hill Orchard.